Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
The True Crime Society podcast contains adult themes and violence and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. And if you'd like to skip the intro or move to any specific part of the podcast, please refer to the timestamps listed in the episode description. Thank you. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the True Crime Society podcast with Stephanie and Olivia. Right now, it's July 3rd, which I don't think it'll really matter with this case because it's an older one. But yeah. We don't know when this one will come out because, as we've said for a few episodes now, we're doing some batch recording just to have some backups to be safe. So right now, it's July 3rd. Tomorrow's July 4th. Not feeling very patriotic. As I'm sure many people are not with the way of the world lately.
July 4th here, just another day.
You're not celebrating the USA? How rude.
Celebrating Friday.
Yeah, right. This was like the longest short week ever because we're off tomorrow for the 4th. So I'm going on vacation tomorrow, starting like in the next week, where I go to North Carolina to see my parents and stuff. So I'm just trying to like pack and get everything together, which of course I'm always like, yeah, I'll get it done. And then at the very like last minute, I'm like, oh shit, I have a lot to do still.
I feel like you always underestimate what you're going to do before you're going to go. And then you're like rushing at the last minute, even if you think you're prepared.
Yeah. Oh, it just lightninged. There's also like a weird storm going on. Ooh, thunder. That was really loud. The storm's supposed to be over.
I still couldn't hear it.
You were having crazy weather.
Yeah, we had this, I think they called it like a bomb cyclone, which is so random.
Oh, we have that with snow sometimes.
Yeah, and so like it just came out of nowhere. The weather's been like lovely and pretty mild and sunny, and then all of a sudden earlier this week, it just was wild. And the first day for us, it was like mainly wind. The wind was so insane. And like, I don't know if it was the last episode we were talking about. And you
said you never lose power.
Yeah, you never lose power. And then that after, I think it was Tuesday, because it's Friday here now. I think it was Tuesday afternoon at 2:30, my husband sent me a text saying the power's just gone out. And then, which I wasn't surprised because it was so windy and there was trees down on power lines and all that. But they kept updating the time. Like I think they said first 11 p.m. and then it went to like 4 p.m. Four, like anyway. So then we were just like, it was 8:30 at night. We're just sitting in the pitch black, like I don't know, frontier people or something. and then we get a text. He got a text because my phone wasn't like where we also live is really shitty phone service, and because we had no Wi-Fi. So he got a text saying it was going to be like 4 p.m. the next day, and I'm like, are you kidding me? And I was so angry. But then 5 minutes later, the power came back on. So I don't know why they're updating saying 4 p.m. Anyway, so we were pretty good, but I know some people in our local area have just had the power come back on like days and days. So we got out very lightly, thankfully. And then the next day was quite rainy, but today it's like not a cloud in the sky, beautiful, still sunny. So a very weird weather phenomenon.
Yeah, knock on wood, for a while I haven't really lost power too much, or if I did, it came on pretty quickly. But I remember when I first moved here, like the first summer right after we moved, I feel like I lost power like once a week. It was ridiculous, especially when my electric bill is so expensive.
Even here, because we live on like an acreage, so if we have no power, we have no water, because we're on tank water, so you need the power, so you can't even like flush the toilet. We had to go to my parents' place for showers. Like all of these I know are very minor inconveniences, but I feel like you just take power for granted, and when you don't have it for a few hours, it's such a pain.
Yeah, but I'm also like, what am I paying for?
And like all these people were whinging on like local Facebook groups. They're like, how come I still don't have power? And people are like, have you seen the conditions outside? Like it is so dangerous for them to be out there fixing it, which I absolutely agree. They should only be out there trying to fix it when it's safe. And I know it's an inconvenience and annoying, but it was just one of those horrible things. It's not just like a random tree, old tree fell down. They could go and move it straight away. It was so dangerous. We even had like people, I could see a light coming down the street at night before our power came back on. And I'm like, what are they doing? But it was the power people checking the power lines with like torches to make sure, I guess, there were no other branches and stuff on them. And our neighbors, a few houses down, they had about 4 trees fall. So thankfully, I think all of our trees have already fallen because of all the crap weather. So they, but you know, all the like street was out there yesterday helping them cut and like get rid of all these trees. So fingers crossed, the weather looks all right for the next week. So who knows? It's just wild times.
Yeah, it does feel like wild times. Okay, so today we are going to be talking about another Canadian case, and we've done a few like back to back, but you know, as we've said many times, I don't know when this episode's going to come out, but we've recorded a few back to back Canadian cases.
It's interesting because I feel like we actually haven't done many Canadian cases at all over the life of this podcast, and in the last few weeks, this will be the third one that we've recorded. So it just is a crazy coincidence that there's been a lot of
Into the archives of suggestions. Canadian cases.
Yeah, our Canadian listeners should be happy about this.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about the case of serial killer Robert Picton. He was also known as the pig farmer or the butcher.
And I think someone actually suggested this. Let me just look it up and I can see.
I thought so too.
I just didn't put it in the notes. So yeah, this one was suggested by our listeners. We had at least two listeners suggest this one. This one was suggested by both Lindsay and Sari. So thank you. And again, I think I said it when we did the Dean Cora one. I was like, oh, like sometimes I feel like serial killers are just, you know, another story, but this one is completely insane and crazy and absolutely horrific, which is what I said about the Dean Cora one too, but it's a really, really truly heinous, horrible case.
Yeah. Crazy how many murders. He confessed to 49 murders and he ended up being convicted of 6 of those just because of like passage of time, really, and like lack of evidence. But most of his victims were, of course, vulnerable sex workers, which seems to be the target of a lot of serial killers. So start some background on him. He has had an interesting life. So Robert William Picton, known as Willie to many, was born on October 24th, 1949, to Leonard Picton and Louise Arnall. Robert had an older sister named Linda Louise Wright and a younger brother named David Francis Picton. Not sure why Linda had a different last name. We couldn't find it really mentioned online anywhere. So
I thought maybe like unless Wright, you know, some people just have a whole bunch of middle names, but like everywhere I've seen to her referred to as Linda Louise Wright, I thought like maybe it's a married name, but that is how they refer to her when she was a child as well. I've tried to find clarification on that. It doesn't really matter. It's just a kind of weird anomaly in the story.
Yeah. So the Pictons were a family of pig farmers that lived in Port Coquitlam in British Columbia, and it's around 27 kilometers or 17 miles east of Vancouver. Linda was sent off from the family to live with relatives when she was a child. Her parents believed that a pig farm was not a great place to raise a little girl, so instead they were just like, get out of here.
It's so wild to me. Like, imagine just knowing that, like, if you have a child, you're not going to be able to kill. Like, I don't know. It's just such a weird mindset. Like, I understand. I probably agree. A pig farm is not a great place to maybe raise any children. But just ship off the little girl somewhere else. Can't be bothered to deal with her because she's female.
Get out of here.
This is our business. Yeah.
So, this isn't for girls. Yeah. Very weird. So Robert and David were made to work at the pig farm from a very early age. Their mother, Louise, was said to be very tough on the children. She was said to have prioritized the pigs over the brothers' personal hygiene and forced them to work long hours doing hard work. That's a crazy sentence. She prioritized the pigs over the children.
Yeah. And I feel like, we'll go into more about Louise, but I feel like probably a lot of the issues of the brothers stemmed from this crazy, horrible mother.
Yeah, she seems kind of like a nightmare.
She seems totally unhinged and horrible.
Yeah. So this info about the family comes from the Toronto Star. It says, a workaholic who ran the family meat business in Port Coquitlam, Louise supervised the kids, expecting them to put in long hours slopping pigs and looking after other animals, even on school days. At one point during his boyhood, people told people told me when Willie wanted to hide from someone, he would crawl into the gutted carcass of large hogs.
Horrible.
Yeah, interesting childhood. This info about Louise is from a medium.com article by Tim Connolly. And we have the links for all these on the blog too. So if you want to read more, the whole thing or anything. So it says Louise Picton, his mom, had few teeth and the ones she had left were rotten. She was loud, fast talking, and often screeched. She had little hair on her head, so often wore a scarf. Louise had long hair that grew out of her chin, as well as a mustache. She habitually wore only a house dress and jeans. Like, okay, Tim.
His article is quite entertaining. Like, I did read it, and I think a lot of it is maybe he's taken a few liberties and been very extra descriptive.
Creative writing.
Like that. Yeah, very creative writing. Like, I have no doubt it's probably based on the truth, but, yeah, a very interesting read and very, very creative about the case. Mm.
If you're a fan of true crime that's both compelling and respectfully told, you need to check out Crime Salad. Each week, husband and wife duo Ashley and Ricky dive deep into both well-known and lesser-covered cases, bringing you well-researched, thoughtfully narrated stories driven by a mission to uncover truth, amplify victims' voices, and advocate for justice. One recent case they covered, a desperate 32-year-old man who risked everything to escape the nightmare he'd been trapped in for years. His prison was a locked room inside a quiet house in Waterbury, Connecticut. Starved, abused, and neglected, he weighed just 68 pounds, which is less than the average 10-year-old. With no way out and no hope left, he made a final desperate choice. He set his room on fire. Using only a lighter, hand sanitizer, and paper, he sparked a blaze that could either end his life or save it. It triggered a race against time as firefighters rushed to a home that no one suspected was hiding a horror story. Kimberly Sullivan, his stepmother, is now charged with imprisoning him for over 2 decades, but she denies everything. Her attorneys claim there's no real evidence tying her to the abuse. This man lost decades of his life, hidden from the world and voiceless, but now his story is being told. Listen to the full episode, The Fire That Freed Him, Kimberly Sullivan's House of Horror, and explore more powerful cases like this one by searching Crime Salad wherever you get your podcasts.
So when the brothers did go to school, they were often filthy and smelled of pig manure, and other kids often called them stinky piggies. You know how kids can be very mean, especially when you do smell like pig manure. Robert was said to be very attached to Louise, and Leonard, the father, was said to have been abusive as well. When Robert was 12, he purchased a calf with his own money. He would later say, "I wanted to sleep with it. I played with the calf, everything else." This info about what happened to the calf is from the Vancouver Sun. The article says, "He walked around the house looking everywhere, asking family members, 'Where's my calf? Where's my calf?' He was horrified when they suggested he look in the barn. No," this quote, "no, no way. They kill animals down there. I told him not to go down there," he said. Little Willie hesitated, first looking around the barn, but avoiding the butchering area. Finally, Picton recounts, "I'll just sneak around the back there and have a look. Anyways, there's my calf, upside down, cleaned out, butchered it." So he got a little baby calf, it seems, and the family slaughtered it anyways. Robert dropped out of school in 1963 when he was around 14 years old. And he began working as a meat cutter. He did that job until he was around 21 when he returned to the Picton Pig Farm to work full time. Farm housed around 700 pigs, jeez, that needs to be cared for 3 times a day. That's crazy.
Yeah, I can't even imagine the amount of work. Like, and pigs are big animals. Like, obviously, yeah. I mean, there's different varieties 700. Of pigs. But 700 of them would be a lot of work.
I feel like 3 would be overwhelming.
Yeah.
Leonard, the dad, he passed away in 1978, and Louise died in 1979, which left the farm to the 3 siblings. They inherited it. Brothers were often referred to in media articles as the Bacon Brothers. In the early 1990s, the siblings sold off parts of the farm for around $5 million.
So I feel like $5 million even sounds like a lot back then, but today that would be worth like $10.5 million. So it's quite a lot of money that they came into, you know, like I feel like the farm was.
And they still had to all like piss away their whole life.
Yeah. Like, so they came, like, even if they split between three, you know, that would be the equivalent of $3 and a bit million each today. Like, it's quite a lot of money to come into, and the farm was still running and all that. So it was a big inheritance for them and a big windfall in the early 90s for them.
Yeah. Hi, Pete. Come here. Okay. Peep's sad because I'm leaving her for vacation.
She's missing her recording next week.
Oh, no. She's mad. Poor thing. I always feel so bad leaving the pets when you go away.
Oh, no. I feel like they know, like, not to get off topic, but I feel like they know, like, anytime we're packing bags, like, the dogs just look so sad. They're like, where are you going? Why are the suitcases out?
A farm employee named Bill Hiscock spoke about the conditions of the property. He said it was a creepy-looking place. He also said that a 600-pound or 275-kilogram boar roamed freely around the farm. He said, I never saw a pig like that, who would chase you and bite at you. It was running out with the dogs around the property. Sounds scary.
Yeah, very scary. Like, I have seen pigs that big at, like, agricultural
shows. Big pigs are
scary. And they are absolutely enormous. Like, I can't even imagine one just roaming around like a dog, like, you know.
Ready to attack.
Yeah.
Bill described Robert as a pretty quiet guy, hard to strike up a conversation with, whose occasional bizarre behavior, despite no evidence of substance abuse, would draw attention. After Robert sold off some of the farm and became wealthy, he also established a makeshift nightclub at the farm. This is, like, one of the weirdest parts of the story to me.
Like, let's just have a nightclub at a filthy, disgusting pig farm.
With 700 pigs. One that roams around and attacks. He called it the Piggy Palace. Bill said that many drunken raves that featured entertainment by an ever-changing cast of downtown Eastside sex workers were held at the Piggy Palace. As some background into the downtown East Side, it is the site of a complex set of social issues, including disproportionately high levels of drug use, homelessness, poverty, crime, mental illness, and sex work.
Yeah, I used to actually live in Vancouver in Canada, and I feel like I lived there right around the time this was happening, but I don't recall this case in the news. I'm sure I just missed it. But the downtown East Side is a very, like, it's a sad place. There's a lot of poverty, a lot of drug use. Like, when we moved there, people would say these are the streets that you need to avoid. Don't, like, just go walking down those streets. It's a very, I don't even know what the word is. It's just a sad place where people go who are
downtrodden.
It's, I think they have also, like, drug clinics and things in that area, so people would, for that reason, congregate down there. But it's an area that houses a lot of vulnerable people.
So over the years, David got into trouble. He was convicted of sexual assault in 1992 and fined $1,000 and given probation. The victim told the police that David had attacked her on the pig farm, but that she'd managed to escape. The brothers started a charity in 1996 called the Piggy Palace Good Times Society, of course.
Sounds legit.
Yeah, sounds like what even is that?
Yeah.
This was said to be a nonprofit society intended to organize, coordinate, manage, and operate special events, functions, dances, shows, and exhibits on behalf of service organizations, sports organizations, and other worthy groups. Like, how's that a charity?
I feel like this is how they were trying to get away with having the nightclub. So they were saying that this venue was the place that the charity would hold all these events, these, you know, special community events. So I feel like it was just a way to more so get around any licensing requirements or any other type of licensing needed to have a nightclub on a pig farm.
Yeah, true. After their siblings opened the Piggy Palace, they were taken to court for violating city zoning ordinances. According to the complaint, their property was zoned for agricultural use, but they had altered a large farm building on the land for the purpose of holding dances, concerts, and other recreations. That sometimes drew as many as 1,800 people, including Hell's Angels. That's a lot of people.
It is.
Following a New Year's Eve party on December 31st, 1998, the Pictons were slapped with an injunction banning future parties, the court order noting that police were henceforth authorized to arrest and remove any person attending public events at the farm. So definitely a vibe killer there. Jumping ahead slightly, their charity did finally lose its nonprofit status in January 2000 for failure to provide mandatory financial statements.
Shocking.
Yeah. It's funny because in my mind, I'm like, oh, that wasn't even that long ago. But I'm like, no, that was still 25 years ago. From the 1990s, women, mainly those who lived on the downtown east side, began to go missing. Many of the missing women were indigenous, suffered from addiction, and were sex workers. In March 1997, Robert was charged with the attempted murder of Wendy Lynn Eisteter. Wendy Lynn was a sex worker, and Robert had stabbed her four times during a fight that they had while at his farm. She told police that he had restrained and handcuffed her, but she managed to escape. After she freed herself, she stabbed Robert, and he had to go to the hospital and seek treatment. He was released on a $2,000 bond, but the charge was later dismissed without explanation in January 1998. It's theorized that the charge was dropped due to Wendy Lynn's addiction issues. Bill Hiscox, who we previously mentioned as a former employee, started to become concerned about the Pictons after he read reports about the missing women. He went to the police and told them that some items belonging to the missing women were at the farm. He said, all the girls that are going missing and all the purses and IDs that are out there in his trailer and stuff. He also told police that Robert frequents the downtown area all the time for girls. Police went to the Picton property three times to search and allegedly found no evidence. I feel like they didn't look very hard.
Yeah, I would agree.
In June 1999, a tip was called in that alleged Robert had a freezer full of human flesh on his property, but again, no real investigation was undertaken for whatever reason. In February 2002, police executed a search warrant at the Picton property. They were searching for illegal firearms. Both of the brothers were arrested. Police got a second search warrant based on what they found on the property, and they now had grounds to search as part of the investigation into the missing women. 67 women had been reported missing from the downtown east side area in previous years. That's a lot of people.
It is.
Robert was bailed on the firearms charge, but was arrested again and charged with two counts of first-degree murder. Authorities identified the victims as Serena Abbotsway and Mona Wilson. In March 2002, authorities confirmed that Serena's DNA had been found at the farm, which I couldn't even imagine looking for just like some DNA at that huge farm with 700 pigs.
Yeah, even like when I posted on Instagram that we were talking about this case today, and someone sent a message saying that for years and years after all this, they found human DNA in the pig's feces for years. So imagine just trying to sort between humans, pigs, you know, it would
yeah, imagine having that job.
Yeah, a nightmare.
Wow. In April 2002, Robert was charged with three more counts of murder. These victims were named as Jacqueline McDonald, Heather Bottomley, and Diane Rock. A sixth murder charge for Angela Josbury was added a few days later. In May 2002, Robert was charged with a seventh first-degree murder charge after the remains of Brenda Wolf were found on the farm. In September that year, Robert was charged with the murders of Georgina Pappin, Patricia Johnson, Helen Hallmark, and Jennifer Firminger. Another four for Heather Chinnick, Tanya Hollick, Sherry Irving, and Inga Hall were laid on October 3rd. On May 26, 2005, 12 more came for Cara Ellis, Andrea Borhaven, Deborah Lynn Jones, Marnie Frey, Tiffany Drew, Carrie Koski, Sarah DeVries, Cynthia Felix, Angela Jardine, Wendy Crawford, Diana Melnick, and Jane Doe, bringing the total to 27. It's just crazy they could even identify
that many of them based on what was probably found.
Yeah. Between February 2002 and November 2003, the investigation at the Picton farm was estimated to have cost around $70 million Canadian. Forensic analysis of everything found was difficult because the bodies had been left to rot or been eaten by pigs on the farm. In 2004, British Columbia health officials issued a warning. They said they believe that Robert may have ground up human flesh and mixed it with pork that he sold to the public.
Mm. kind of imagine. That's just imagine maybe. Like, I know that they've said we'll get into it, but they said the risk was quite low. But imagine having purchased that and maybe have consuming human flesh unknowingly. It's horrible.
Yeah, imagine like I shop there all the time. Yeah. Or I got meat from them all the time. Ugh. British Columbia Health Officer Perry Kendall said, given the state of the farm and what we know about the investigation, we cannot rule out the possibility that cross-contamination may have occurred. Even like, not only that, but I just feel like someone who is this busy, like murdering, like the conditions could not have been cleanly and great.
Yeah, and general. Like, how were they, why, like, I still have all these questions, like, even when that person said the condition of the farm, how were they able to still maybe provide meat to the public if it was such a feral place? It's, and this was only, like, I know it was still 20 years ago, but, like, recent. It wasn't like it was the 1950s or something. It was pretty recent that all this was happening.
Yeah, I guess you kind of hear that a lot of these types of, like, meatpacking farms can be pretty disgusting.
Yeah.
Mr. Kendall added, cross-contamination could mean that human remains did get into or contaminate some of the pork meat. He said the risk to human health for those who consume the product is extremely remote, based on the fact most pork products are typically well-cooked, which is known to effectively destroy most infectious agents. I just couldn't imagine if one of your loved ones or family members was a victim and then hearing that they were potentially turned into ground meat that was eaten by the public.
Horrible. Just another aspect, like another horrible aspect to have to deal with, like the indignity of dying and having your remains disposed of like that.
Sickening. Robert's trial began on January 30th, 2006. He pled not guilty to all 27 charges of first-degree murder.
Before we get into the episode, today's show is sponsored by Skylight. You can say goodbye to your sticky notes and any calendar confusion with Skylight. The Skylight calendar is here to keep your family organized. This beautifully designed digital display syncs with your existing calendars, making it effortless to track events, appointments, reminders, all in one easy-to-see place. We keep ours in our pantry so the kids can look at it. We know what everyone's got on each day. It's so handy, so easy to use. We all love our Skylight calendar. Skylight Calendar was designed to connect the digital and non-digital worlds while bringing families together. It's Wi-Fi connected, it has a digital display that showcases your family's schedule with clarity, color, and brilliance in either a 10 or 15 inch HD touchscreen. With the free Skylight Companion app, you can add and update events, lists, and more on the go. Your happiness is also Skylight's happiness. So if in 120 days you are not 100% thrilled with your purchase, you can return it for a full refund, no questions asked. Right now, Skylight is offering our listeners $30 off their 15-inch calendars by going to skylightcal.com/TCS. Go to skylightcal.com/TCS for $30 off your 15-inch calendar. That's skylightcal.com/TCS.
The voir dire phase of the trial took most of the year to determine what evidence might be admitted before a jury. So what does voir dire mean? It's a preliminary examination of a witness or the jury pool by a judge or counsel. Voir dire interrogation of the board members did not bode well for their case. Reporters were not allowed to disclose any of the material presented in the arguments. On March 17th, one of the counts was rejected by Justice James Williams for lack of evidence.
I do feel like the Canadian legal system is obviously quite similar to the Australian legal system because we are both Commonwealth nations and all that type of stuff. So again, it always happens here where there's these gag orders, there's the bans placed on what can be reported. And even like when we spoke about the Grace Mullane case in New Zealand, the same type of thing where they put kind of restraints on what the public are able to be told at the time.
Yeah. It seems almost like a grand jury maybe in a way or similar. By August that year, the judge had severed the charges, split them into two groups, one of 6 counts and another of 20. The trial ended up proceeding on 6 counts. The other 20 charges were stayed. The judge explained that this occurred because it would have placed an unreasonable burden on the jury. The trial could have lasted for up to 2 years. It would have also increased the chance of a mistrial.
I feel for the families of the victims who never got a trial, but I do understand that reasoning. Like, you know, it makes more sense to proceed with what you know with certainty rather than try to have this enormous
risk it all.
Charges. Yeah, basically to risk it all. All right, so these are the victims that Robert was tried for the murders of. They were Marnie Frey, Serena Abbotsway, Georgina Papin, Andrea Joes Bree, Brenda Wolfe, and Mona Wilson. I just thought it was important to include some information about each of those victims. Obviously, there are many, many, many more, but these are the ones that we know probably the most information about. Marnie Frey went missing in 1997. Around the time of her disappearance, her father Rick was commercially fishing. He recalls that he was alone on the boat, seeing news flashes that bodies were being found, and he wondered if it was his daughter. He said, "Do you know how hard it is when you're by yourself? Is that my daughter? Tears run down my face when I think about it." Serena Abbotsway was 29 when she disappeared in August 2001. She was reported missing by her foster mother. Serena's brother wrote that Serena did not choose to live life the way she did. Circumstances chose it for her. He said that Serena quite often was, when talking to us on the phone, would make sure to ask us that the younger foster children would never end up living the life that she was living. So sad. Reported missing by a foster mother, obviously had a broken home life. Mm-hmm. She was aware of, you know, she just was in a hole and she couldn't get out of it. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Georgina Papin is remembered by her friends and family as a caring mother, sister, and friend. They said that she was a talented artist and writer, and she was the mother of 7 children. She's described as warm and funny, and she could talk to anyone, the sort of person who made friends wherever she went. Teaching dancing, songs, and art had an important place in her life. Andrea Josbury ran away at the age of 16, and she lived in the downtown east side with a boyfriend who was 20 years older than her. She had a child with him who was removed from their care after her partner went to jail. She kept in touch with her family through phone calls, and she was in a methadone program at the time of her disappearance, and she was 23 when she disappeared. Brenda Wolfe was born in Lethbridge, Alberta, and she was the oldest of 5 children. She had 2 sisters and 2 brothers. She was raised in Calgary. She grew up with her father's family while her mother battled alcohol addiction, but she moved in with her mother in 1980. Her mother later learned that Brenda had been abused by members of her father's family. Brenda was a badminton champion in school, and she was a talented hairdresser. She had 2 daughters, and in 1996, she moved to Vancouver. Her common law spouse was abusive towards Brenda, and Brenda was afraid of him. She even moved to a shelter in an attempt to leave. She worked as a waitress and a bouncer in the bar at the Balmoral Hotel in the downtown east side. She was well known in the community as a protector and was said to be soft-spoken and well-liked. Mona Wilson was born in British Columbia, and she was the youngest of 7 children. She moved to Vancouver with her mother when she was young, and she was separated from her siblings. Mona was removed from the house and was placed in foster care after she was abused by her mother's boyfriend. She lived with a foster mother who was a community worker in the downtown east side until she was 8, so she was in that area even as a child. And then she lived in the Fraser Valley with another family and eventually lived in group homes as a teenager. She moved to the downtown east side again in her late teens after she dropped out of school in grade 9. Before she went missing, she was living in East Vancouver with her partner, and she was often seen cleaning car windows. She was last seen at the end of November in 2001. So all of these women were obviously very vulnerable, were picked right by mm-hmm. Robert for that reason. Very, very yeah. sad. So the trial ended up starting on January 22nd, 2007. As we mentioned, there was an initial media ban on the trial. It was eventually lifted, and I've picked out some parts of the trial to share because obviously it was a very long proceeding. We can't run through the entire trial here. So I've picked out just some parts that highlight the heinousness and awfulness of these crimes. Mm-hmm. Even though we know that Robert was originally charged with 20 plus murders, then it was kind of cut down to 6, he did confess to murdering 49 women. He said to police, "I was going to do one more and make it an even 50. I made my own grave by being sloppy." Around 80 unidentified DNA profiles were found on evidence taken from the pig farm. Those profiles were around 50% male to 50% female. I feel like that is kind of expected. Obviously, they had workers on the farm. You know, I'm sure there were people coming and going. The 50-50 split yeah. is interesting though, but 80 unidentified profiles were found. Mm-hmm. Police seized a revolver with a dildo over the barrel and one round fired, boxes of Magnum handgun ammunition, night vision goggles, 2 pairs of faux fur-lined handcuffs, a syringe with 3 milliliters of blue liquid inside, and a Spanish fly aphrodisiac from Robert's trailer. Robert Sounds tried sketchy. to Yeah, Robert tried to explain the dildo, which is, this is the stupidest excuse I've ever heard. He said that he had put it on the gun to try and create a makeshift silencer. So they, okay. In court proceedings, they basically went through that there was no way that would be the reasoning for why he did that.
Yeah.
The prosecution also described the discovery of two heads in a bucket that were found in the freezer during a search of the farm. They said the heads of the individuals had been cut into vertically with the skulls were left and right hands and the front parts of the left and right feet. A friend of Robert's named Scott Chubb also testified. He said that Robert told him a good way to kill a heroin addict was to inject her with windscreen washer fluid. Another associated named Andrew Bellwood said that Robert had said he'd been killing sex workers by handcuffing and strangling them. Robert had told him that he would bleed and gut the women before feeding them to the pigs. They also showed photos of the slaughterhouse in court, and one photo showed a garbage can that held remains of one of the victims, Mona Wilson.
Ugh, so sad to be, like, treated that way.
Yeah, horribly. And, you know, if he would bleed and gut them, like, maybe they were still alive and had, like, I hope they didn't, but that could have been a slow death and horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. On December 9th, 2007, Robert was found not guilty on the 6 counts of first-degree murder, but he was thankfully found guilty on 6 counts of second-degree murder. On December 11th that year, 2007, after reading 18 victim impact statements, British Columbia Supreme Court Judge Justice James Williams sentenced Robert to life with no possibility of parole for 25 years, which is the maximum punishment for second-degree murder, and equal to the sentence that would have been imposed for a first-degree murder conviction. He said, Mr. Picton's conduct was murderous and repeatedly so. I cannot know the details, but I know this. What happened to them was senseless and despicable. Mr. Picton, there is nothing I can really say to express the revulsion the community feels about these killings. The British Columbia Attorney General Wally Opal at the time told CBC that regardless of the judge's decision, it was very unlikely that Robert would ever be able to convince a parole board to release him. He said it will be very difficult to ever conclude that Mr. Picton will see the light of day again. On January 7th, the next year, 2008, the Attorney General filed an appeal to the British Columbia Court of Appeal against Robert's first-degree murder acquittals. The relatives of the victims expressed concern that the convictions would be jeopardised if the Crown to argue that the trial judge had made errors. The families of the victims had been told that this appeal was not going to occur. The BC Attorney General, Wally Opal, apologised to the victims' families for not informing them about the appeal before it was announced to the general public. He also said that the appeal was filed largely for strategic reasons in anticipation of an appeal by the defence. The appeal happened so quickly after the verdict because basically the Crown had 30 days after December 9 when the verdict was rendered to appeal, and the time period for the defence to appeal expired 30 days after December 11, which was when Robert was sentenced. So it all happened very quickly after the trial. Like, you know, most appeals take quite a while, you know, but this all happened very quickly.
Yeah.
On January 9th, 2008, Robert's lawyers launched their own appeal and attempted to overturn the second-degree murder convictions. Just to keep this chronological, so jumping ahead a little bit, in February 2009, the remaining siblings, Robert's siblings, his sister and his brother, sued the Attorney General and others for damages resulting from searches of the farm. Oh. Their lawsuit claimed that the RCMP search of the farm where Robert lived had destroyed equipment and the terrain that the siblings had lawful rights to use.
Well, maybe sue your brother for doing that.
And also, I there's not much known about the sister. I tried to find a lot about her, but the brother was
even
also an horrible human being. I think she did come back when they inherited the farm, but he was a horrible human being too, the brother. So this is I know it's not really the same, but it did remind me a little bit of Arsa and the Gilgo, where she's like, they destroyed my house. Whereas I feel like this was disgusting mess anyway.
Yeah.
But part of their claim said, as a result of the said actions by the RCMP, the properties are presently useless and the plaintiffs have suffered significant loss and damage. The RCMP disturbed, disrupted, killed and destroyed various plants, trees, ground covers and other vegetation and the fish in the pond on the properties. That was their lawsuit at the time. To keep it chronological, we'll come back to what happened, and this will go back to Robert's legal issues now.
Imagine having the balls to be like the fish in the pond on the properties when
I'm sure they how many women were murdered for there. Those fish, like what? It's ridiculous. It's
so weird.
So the British Columbia Court of Appeal issued its decisions on January 25th, 2009. They did ban some of their decisions from publication. It dismissed the defense appeal by a 2-1 majority. Due to a dissent on the point of law, Robert was entitled to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada without first seeking leave of appeal. Now, there's a lot of appeal words in here, but basically he could have gone higher than what his original appeal started at.
Yeah.
The Court of Appeal allowed the Crown Appeal, finding that the trial judge erred in excluding some evidence and in severing 6 counts from the rest. The order resulting from this severance was stayed so that the conviction on the 6 counts of second-degree murder was not set aside. Robert and his team confirmed on June 26, 2009, that he would appeal to the Supreme Court. In November that year, the Supreme Court of Canada granted the application for leave of appeal. The effect of this was to broaden the scope of Robert's appeal, allowing him to raise arguments that had previously been rejected by the court. On July 30th, though, 2010, despite all of these, legal proceedings, appeals, the Supreme Court of Canada rendered its decision dismissing the appeal and it upheld all of the convictions. The justices of the Supreme Court unanimously rejected the idea that Robert should have been given a new trial. That same year, British Columbia Crown spokesman Neil McKenzie announced that the prosecution of the other 20 murder charges would be discontinued. He said, in reaching this position, the branch has taken into account the fact that any additional convictions could not result in any increase to the sentence that Mr. Picton has already received. Again, a blow for the victims, but I feel like cost-wise and time-wise, there's no point in trying to pursue extra charges. This is what I always wonder about with Lori Vallow. Why are they proceeding with these other charges when she will never, ever be out of prison? I guess it is about justice for the victims.
Yeah.
In this case, they just said, I guess the scale of the legal proceedings was just too much for what the outcome would have been. In 2013, the children of 13 of the victims filed a lawsuit against the Vancouver Police Department, the RCMP and the Crown for failing to protect the victims. A settlement was reached in 2014 and each child received around Canadian $50,000, which I feel is not a huge amount, but better than nothing, I guess. The families claimed in their lawsuits that the Vancouver Police and the RCMP were negligent when they investigated reports of missing sex workers and the possibility that Robert might be responsible. The court said that the Crown was wrong when it didn't put Robert on trial for attempted murder following the attack that we reported on the sex worker in 1997. So they were kind of arguing that there were all these signs pointing to Robert being a horrible person. They searched the farm multiple times. Maybe if things had have happened more thoroughly, more women wouldn't have died.
Yeah.
That was the argument of why they were compensated. Back to the lawsuit by the siblings. In January 2013, Louise and David dropped the lawsuit. This lawsuit was resolved without settlement or costs being assigned to any of the parties involved. So I guess they just kind of gave up on that.
Yeah.
In February 2024, so very recently, Robert became eligible to apply for day parole. No parole board, though, meeting was ever scheduled for him. So he never did apply, which we'll get into why, because a bit of a spoiler. That same year, May 19th, 2024, Robert was attacked by another inmate at the institution where he was being held in Quebec. The prisoner was a man named Martin Charest, and he was described as having a history of assaulting other prisoners. It said that he speared Robert in the head with a broken broom-like handle. So obviously, people always wonder, how can you get a weapon in jail? Obviously, this guy was probably assigned to a cleaning position. Had access to probably a wooden or even a metal broom, broke the handle and basically stabbed him in the head.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Yeah. What a shame. Robert was taken to hospital and he was put on life support. He died on May 31st, 2024 from complications of his injuries. So, I know he did spend nearly 20 years in jail, but still not justice for what he did to probably close to 50 women.
Yeah, hopefully he suffered and it wasn't a quick death.
Yeah. The location of the former pig farm is basically abandoned now. I had a look at it on Google Street View. It's such a random place. Like, basically now it just looks like a big field. Obviously everything has been demolished. There's houses right next to it. It's in quite a residential area. Obviously over the years I'm sure it's been built up from what it was, but it's basically just a big open field. There are some piles of dirt and stuff, but it's just a random field now.
Yeah.
Over the years, people have petitioned to turn the park into a memorial site. A sex trade rights activist named Jamie Lee Hamilton said the land is a cemetery, which is not wrong, and it should be treated with dignity. The only information, though, I can find about that is from a 2008 article, so it doesn't really appear like anything has happened along the lines of making it a memorial. At the time, former city councillor Art Cowie said they had been designing the proposed memorial. What we do need to do is make this a beautiful place where people can come, where there's flowers and there's trees, and it's a welcoming place for memorialization, not only for the women who died here, but for the many people in the surrounding community and region. But nothing's happened. Like, I was reading an article and they said as of 2023, it's basically still a derelict site. Nothing's happened.
Of course.
Yep. So one thing I was interested in trying to find out is what has happened to the siblings. The sister seems to be keeping quite a low profile. There is a lot of discussion, mainly on Reddit, not surprisingly, about the brother. This is one quote I picked out. Like, there's actually a whole Reddit thread. What happened to Willie Picton's brother? Someone said, he's not in prison, if that's what you're asking. He's been accused of sexual assault a few times over the past 10 or so years, but people believe he may be currently living on Vancouver Island. A lot of people in this Reddit thread have also said there's rumors, which I feel like there's always going to be rumors about this, that he's been seen on the downtown east side. Like, I have questions about his involvement in the case.
Yeah,
like,
I was wondering
surely
too.
He must have known what was
had
going
some
on.
Some idea.
He was definitely involved in the whole Piggy Palace and the whole soliciting of victims. So it's just interesting to me that he was never charged with any of the murders. This is one other comment that I found interesting. It says, he was the brains behind the business. What Willie was doing with the sex workers was his own little hobby. They used to get paid to get rid of the bodies. So I feel it does sound like Robert was probably the murderer, but I have no doubt the brother knew what was going on.
Yeah, I feel like there's no way he couldn't have.
Yeah. This is another comment. In the last 5 years, he was spotted cruising the downtown east side. His photo was run in the bad date sheets discussed in a podcast. I was working in the area. Many locals believe Willie took the fall for a larger conspiracy, as in the Hell's Angels. You know, he always used to be involved, so maybe he, I don't know. I just feel like he was an absolute horrible person. It could have been something along those lines that I would not be shocked if more people were involved and knew about these murders.
Especially, they said some parts there was like 1,800 people.
Yeah.
On a gross pig farm.
Someone else said that he owns a bulldozing demolition and excavation company. My partner had him on one of our job sites last year. Yeah. Very on trend. And this is one of the last comments I read. Both brothers were involved in disposing of bodies for various organizations, including the police. The killing and disposal of the sex workers was Robert's pastime. His brother knew, so did the police and quite a few others who turned a blind eye because of the service that the brothers provided them. Robert picked and deserved to die for what he did, but that is not why he was killed. He was killed because he was going to name names. That's for only
that'd be interesting.
So people are still discussing this conspiracies. You know, maybe
that sounds like a movie plot.
Why he was murdered in prison. Someone else is right. Would anyone pay to know his location and phone number? So I feel like it's one of those cases where there were so many shady people involved. There's always going to be conspiracies, discussion.
And just bizarre. Did
he act alone? Who knew about it? What were his motivations? I feel like he had sounds like a pretty horrible childhood. Imagine having to crawl up into a dead pig to hide, or, you know, like, the inside of a dead pig.
Yeah.
You know, even obviously the calf incident really impacted him because he spoke about that as an adult. He's, you know, he obviously had a horrible, heinous childhood. I just feel like he probably grew up to be an awful human being and preyed on vulnerable women for his own pleasure and fun.
Yeah, it seems like it. I wonder if he had like hatred towards women because he had like hatred towards his mom.
His mother took it out. It sounds like he had mother issues. Absolutely. When I first started reading
like
it,
Bates Motel.
A lot of the articles focus on Louise and her treatment of the boys and how that probably led to some of this happening, which I would agree with.
Yeah.
Yeah. As we mentioned, we mainly went into information about the victims that he ended up being charged with. There are a lot of other women. There's so many websites out there dedicated to the victims if you want to learn more about their lives and, you know, their circumstances and how it came to this. It's absolutely a case where you can deep dive if you want to learn more about the court proceedings. We've just tried to give you an overview here of the main information, the main parts, just in case, because I'm sure, I feel like there's probably a lot of people who aren't familiar with this one.
I've like heard of it in passing, but I never really read too much into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's it for this episode. Everything will be on the blog at truecrimesocietyblog.com. And thank you to everyone who sent this case in. We love when you guys suggest cases to us, so keep that up. You could just message them to us on Instagram or email them to us, send them to us. Instagram's probably the easiest if you're on there.
Less likely to miss it too. It's the most reliable.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So we're True Crime Society on Instagram. We're just posting current updates and all that there. We didn't even talk about like all the Brian Koberger stuff because who knows when this episode's going to come out. We'll have to I'm sure more stuff's going to come out. So yeah, make sure you're following us on Instagram. We're always posting updates and following the latest cases and everything on there if you want to see what we're up to. My Instagram is stephsum_olivia's tcsolivia, and you can follow us there. Check us out on Patreon. We do weekly bonus episodes. We also do all the episodes ad-free, so you'd get 2 episodes a week without ads. And Patreon's like its own little fun community. We also do earlier release of the main episode, so you'd get it the day before. Check us out on Patreon if you want more content from us. Otherwise, all the usual stuff you could share with your friends, family, whoever, posting your Instagram stories. Love to see what you guys are up to while you're listening to the podcast, see what hobbies you guys have. It's fun to reshare them. Just keep doing that. Leave some nice Spotify comments. Make sure you're still following on whatever platform and all that. But that is it. So thank you guys for listening. Stay safe out there. Peace out.
See ya.